whole proposition behind Extinction Rebellion and the whole civil resistance model is we can't wait. What we need to do is proactively create, non-violently, a massive disruption which triggers this explosion that opens the prison door so that the whole system gets shaken up. And the point I'm trying to make is it's entirely possible through creating civil resistance.
That's Roger Hallam, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Roger Hallam on Extinction Rebellion, the Climate Crisis, and Civil Resistance. Extinction Rebellion, also simply known as XR, is a global environmental movement. It was founded in the UK with the explicit aim of using nonviolent civil resistance to compel government action to avoid ecological collapse. The latest UN IPCC report paints a dire picture of what the future will bring. By 2050, 1 billion people will face coastal flooding from rising seas. Using radical tactics, Extinction Rebellion draws inspiration from grassroots movements such as abolishing slavery and the civil rights movement. XR aims to instill a sense of urgency to prevent further climate breakdown and the ongoing sixth mass extinction. A number of XR activists accept arrest and imprisonment. The movement's symbol is a stylized circled hourglass to serve as a warning that time is running out for us. To talk about Extinction Rebellion, the climate crisis, and civil resistance is Roger Hallam. He's a Welsh organic farmer and environmental activist. He is co-founder of Extinction Rebellion and the political party Burning Pink. He spoke in London, England.
So I'm going to tell you the really bad news, which has to be at the center of our understanding of what we have to do at this point in history. Number one, what we're being told is a systematic lie. It's so much worse than we think. Number two, so much worse than we think is beyond appalling. We're talking about global economic and social collapse in the next 10 to 20 years. That's what the climate crisis means. We have 3 to 4 years to stop the climate crisis. The reason is because there's all these feedbacks, right? The Arctic is going to melt by 2030, 2035 in the summer. The Greenland ice sheet is going to melt. It's past its tipping point. 7 meters of sea level rise are locked in. The currents around Greenland, they may collapse in the next 2 or 3 decades. The Amazon is going to die back at 20%, 25%. It's 17% cut down at the moment. So we're looking at 3 to 4 years before we get to the tipping point. Then we've got West Antarctica, you know, these massive glaciers. No one quite knows whether we've hit the tipping point, but, you know, guess what? It's not going to be long. In other words, once this has happened, we're done. We're done. We're not able to come back. You can't go to the Arctic in 10 years and go, oh, sorry, I didn't realise. No one's going to be able to refreeze the Arctic when it's melted. No one, right? No one's going to be able to bring back the Amazon. You can't stop the world's greatest glaciers from sliding into the sea. So, like, this is like nothing else in the history of humanity. You know, for the last 10,000 years, every time there's a social conflict, it's not everything forever. We've never experienced that before. So, for instance, you know, 200 years ago, you'd be involved in, if you're in the UK, you'd be fighting against slavery, right? So you'd be going to meetings. And it took about 50 years to get rid of slavery in the UK. It was a long, long, long campaign. And everyone agreed it was obscene and outrageous and disgusting. But everyone also knew that if you didn't sort out slavery this year, it'd be outrageous and disgusting next year, but it wouldn't be 10 times as bad as this year. And in 3 years' time, it wouldn't be 100 times as bad. That's the situation with the climate crisis. You're either going to stop it or you're going to lose it. And that's the end of humanity. And the end of humanity, by the way, is one of those nice little euphemisms, talking about the rape, slaughter, and starvation of billions of people. If you don't stop it in 4 years, that's it. So it's a little bit like this. So everyone sort of knows this story. It's a little kid in the park, and he kicks the ball, and it goes down the hill. Everyone knows that. Everyone knows there's only two ends to the story, which is the kid runs after the ball, and he either catches the ball and stops the ball, or he doesn't, and it rolls down the hill. There's no half catch the ball. It's either you catch it or you don't. That's the climate crisis. That's what an emergency means. How are we going to get to that point? Okay, so the climate crisis. We're being lied to. It's so much worse than we think it is. And we got 3 or 4 years. Everything we think about from now on has to be centered around that. When we're thinking strategically, we need to know what we're dealing with, and that's what we're dealing with. So that's like beyond bad. But what I want to focus on is the good news. The good news is that it's entirely possible, okay? It's entirely possible to change the situation, okay? So why am I saying that? I'm saying that not because I sort of like made it up one morning. I'm saying it because if you look at history, over and over and over again in history, societies face annihilation, societies faced unbelievable levels of injustice, and something happens. And everything changes in 3 to 6 months. And that's interesting. So it's like it's not that it's never happened. In fact, it's happened loads of times. So really the challenge is to look at what happens in those episodes. What we want to look at is what are the common features? Because as it happens, all those episodes have similarities. So that's what we need to focus on. We don't need to focus on conventional campaigning. We don't want to focus on, you know, what everyone thinks out there about how to bring about change. We want to be focusing concretely on the history of success. What does the history of success look like? So I'm going to choose one episode. So it's the Freedom Riders episode in 1961 in the US. So as some of you may know, with the civil rights movement, broadly speaking, there was this amazing episode, the Montgomery bus boycotts, and 20,000 black people decided they weren't going to be humiliated and be segregated on the buses. And they boycotted the buses, and it was amazingly successful, and it came out of nowhere, and it made Martin Luther King's name, and everyone was going, oh my God, after decades of outrageous racism and all the rest of it, it was like something concrete had happened. It was a success. And everyone thought, oh wow, this is it. We're gonna be going for it. So after Montgomery, what happened? Well, nothing happened. Broadly speaking, nothing happened. Like there were big conflicts about organization and, you know, strategy and different organ, you know, all this sort of stuff. And this often happens in the history of political change. It's really difficult to replicate things that just come out of nowhere. But by 1961, people were getting really pissed off, unsurprisingly, particularly younger people, because they're going, we're not going to have another half century of this, right? Jim Crow and all this stuff. So what happened? There wasn't like a big consensus building process in the civil rights movement, you know, big conferences. There wasn't a big consultation exercise to find out what everyone thought. What happened was 12, 15 people decided to do whatever it takes. So that's the first thing I want to like propose here as a baseline of what it means to stop the climate crisis. First of all, you have to do whatever it non-violently takes. So what did that mean? What it meant was these, I think it was 12 of them, black and white people, they got on a bus, they were sitting together, black and white people, which was technically illegal in the southern states. They didn't stop in Virginia where they might be arrested for a night and, you know, just sent packing. They went down to the heart of darkness, the most racist, fascist state in America, which was Alabama at the time. And when they got down there, they were pulled off the bus, they were beaten up, the bus was set on fire, and they were put in prison. And then what happened? 3 days later, out of nowhere, 24 students from Atlanta, I think it was, they decided to replicate. They decided to go on the buses to Alabama, and they got stopped, and they were beaten up, and they were put into prison. And then what happened? Another group came down, another group, and another group. What was motivating these people? These people were potentially risking their lives. They're certainly risking physical violence. They're risking a massive amount of abuse. What their motivation was we can't afford to lose. So that's the second thing I want you to keep in mind here, right? You've got to do whatever it non-violently takes. And you have to realize that we can't afford to lose. Now that sounds familiar, doesn't it? We've got 3 to 4 years to save the next thousand generations. The stress of it is enormous. It's an absolute no-brainer that we can't afford to lose. So we have to do whatever it non-violently takes. That's the proposition. And when all these groups came down, right, they were put into prison. And by the end of the summer, I think it was 430 people from all walks of life had joined this Freedom Riders campaign, and they were in prison in Mississippi. And then they won. So you notice that was whatever. It was May to September. It was less than 6 months. And that win, massively galvanized the civil rights movement. The sacrifice, the heroism, the determination, the continuing at it, the mobilization. And there were hundreds of other campaigns which were directly inspired by that. And it proved that civil disobedience worked, and it paved the way to Selma and Birmingham, the big classic civil rights campaigns. In other words, it changed history. And it started with a small number of people. Let's just look at a recent example. So the example everyone looks at is April 2019 with the rebellion in the UK. But what a lot of people don't get about April 2019 is that I did a plan for it in Christmas 2018, and I presented it to a whole load of XR people. A lot of them went, "Don't like it." You know, it's really bad because everyone's going to be talking about Brexit. You know, no one's going to know. No one cares about the climate crisis, for God's sake. You're not going to get, the proposition was to get 10,000 people into London. They said, there's no way you're going to get 10,000 people into London. And then the proposition was lots of people would engage in civil disobedience to the point of arrest. And they're going, people don't want to get arrested. And then lastly, they were going, if people get arrested, then you're going to put off the public. And those of us that were pushing this forward, the central argument we used was, we can't afford not to risk it. The risk is in not acting because we haven't got time. We have to go for it, even if we fail. So just before April 2019 was a plan to take 5 sites. And lots of people said, you're never going to take 5 sites. The police are going to stop you. We should just take Marble Arch in London and everyone will be happy. And, you know, the police would let us do it and we could put all resources there. And what we said was, if we just take Marble Arch, we're going to be on, you know, page 5 of The Guardian and someone's PhD thesis, right? You're not going to change history. In other words, you need to take a massive risk, like the Freedom Riders did. They didn't stop in Virginia, right? They didn't think, well, we've done our bit. They said, we have to do whatever it takes, right? Because we can't afford to lose. We can't afford to lose, so we're going to take those 5 sites. And so with the Freedom Riders and with April 2019, they have these similar characteristics. And there's different elements, and you have to bring these elements together to change history, to stop the climate crisis. So with April 2019, right, there were different elements. We went to London, the capital city, went with 10,000 people, 1,200 people were arrested. We stayed for 10 days. It was totally non-violent, right? There were 5 key elements. Now, if you've just done 1 or 2 of them, no one would even know about it. It's what's called radically nonlinear. Because we did those 5 things, we made history. And people all around the world, millions of people were empowered because we took that risk. Okay, so what I'm going to do now is just spend a little bit of time talking about the theoretical basis. Okay, because we need to have an idea about how the world works and how society works before we start designing the practicalities. So the first thing I want to talk about just for a minute or two is this notion of political will. when you read all the articles in the press, you have this, you know, the world's terrible, all these things are happening, and then we want to do all these policy changes. And in the final paragraph, they go, and all we need is political will. So for me, like, that's really bad. I mean, it's really bad intellectually. Because first of all, what actually is political will? Like, are you actually going to describe it? Because if you're not actually going to say what political will is, then all you're doing is re-describing the problem. It's a bit like, climate change is really bad, and so we should make it less bad. Well, obviously, right? You're just re-describing the problem. The problem is how you actually get society to move. How is it do you actually get a society to change? How do you create this political will? Well, that's what we're going to investigate. So let's just say what doesn't work in the context of this massive emergency. So the conventional practice is what sometimes is called consciousness raising. So consciousness raising is important, okay? Consciousness raising is a nice word for saying people know there's a problem, because maybe people don't know there's a problem. So you go out there and you do leafleting and do conferences and talk to people in the street and, you know, get people together and say, hey, there's a climate crisis, didn't you know? Consciousness raising is necessary, but it's radically insufficient to radically change society in the next 3 years. So the point here is people already know, right? I mean, I've got a friend who's a researcher in Spain, and he always says to me, they don't need more leaflets telling them. What they need to know is what to do. So like a little iconic sort of episode, if you've seen the film Selma about Martin Luther King. Martin Luther King comes into Selma and there's all these great guys who have done consciousness raising and they're going, great, we've done all this stuff and, you know, leave us to it. And Martin Luther King says, well, what actually has changed? And they're going, well, not much. And he's saying, right, so what we're going to do is disruption. Disruption is a completely different kettle of fish. And what Martin Luther King is saying is, we're coming in to do disruption to make a fundamental change, because you're dealing with entrenched power. Entrenched power does not move through persuasion. It doesn't move through information. It doesn't move through conferences and, you know, private meetings. It changes through raw power conflict, civil resistance. That's, over the whole of history, is how things change. Yes, you need to be clear there's a problem. Yes, you need to make your arguments. But without material struggle is what is the name of the game. So in the modern period, with the climate activists sort of seen, as it were, there's this sort of otherworldliness that we're just here to perform our objection, to protest, right? Protest means to go to the powers of be and say we don't agree with them. It's beyond useless. Like, there's just been the Extinction Rebellion. I think we're on the last day. And there's a little section on one of the write-ups. It said, we go to the City of London to highlight the injustice of this, that, and the other. Like, you highlight something when you're writing an essay in university. You don't highlight something if you want to change it. You force that change. The point is how you are actually going to change it. And if we're going to understand how to change it, we have to understand this conception of, like, social repression. Now, social repression is really interesting. And if you talk to sort of gradualist reformist people, like I talked to NGO people before XR and, you know, even afterwards, and they were going, there's no appetite for radical change, Roger. You know, you can't get thousands of people on the street. It's just not going to happen. Look, everyone's apathetic. So this is what I call, like, shallow empiricism, in the sense that you observe everyone doing nothing and therefore you make an assumption which can't be verified. So it could be for two reasons. They might be just walking along the street doing nothing because they really don't care. You know, it's like climate crisis, what's that? Or they could be walking along the street going, Nothing's happening, so I'm doing nothing. In other words, the social repression. Everyone hates what's going on, but there's no mechanism to create change. So empirically, they're still, you know, under both scenarios, they're still just walking down the street, right? But they're completely different situations if you have social repression. An example of this is like Soviet Russia before 1989. So you may know, like, all the analysts that were just looking at people walking down the street and going, Soviet Union's going to be there for years. The state's enormously powerful. They control the propaganda machine. No one's got any power. And then suddenly, bang, the whole thing collapses out of nowhere. And everyone's going, how did it happen? Well, they should have looked a little bit closer, because if you looked under the surface, people were just, they completely lost faith in the system. So that sort of sounds familiar, doesn't it? Because across the Western world, millions of people, the majority of people, have lost a sort of deep faith in the system. And that's getting even more sort of antagonized by the realization we're going to hell and their children are potentially going to their deaths. That's creating this massive social repression. In other words, you get social repression when society is living a massive lie. And this society is living this massive lie that all of that out there is fine and it's going to carry on and we can have economic growth, but it's all bollocks, right? Because there's this thing called physics. So that's really interesting. And we need to think about that when we're designing how we're going to stop the climate crisis. Okay, so we've got social repression. We know what that looks like. So second, like, key idea is non-linearity. What that means is everything's trundling along and suddenly it goes, everything hits off. So these two things are very related in the sense that if you've got all this repression, it's like nothing seems to be happening. Everyone's really mad. Everyone's depressed. Everyone's in despair, but nothing's happening. So nothing's happening. And then suddenly something happens. So how does that happen? I've got one or two little analogies here. So one analogy is like second visual aid. Okay, so here's a prison, right? Here's the prison, there's the wall. Everyone's in the prison, right? Observationally, they're just all walking around doing their ordinary life, right? But in actual fact, they're all mad as hell because they're in a prison, but the door's shut, so they can't get out. So they could be all happy as far as we know, because they're still just walking around doing their everyday life. But in actual fact, they're as mad as hell because they're in a prison and that prison is going to kill them sooner or later. That's the situation with the world at present. So you just need this, like, in a social repression situation, you just need that door, that prison door, to open a little bit. And suddenly, out of nowhere, all these people go, out of the door. They're pushing through that with all their life force, right? So this is like the Soviet Union, like nothing's happening. Suddenly it collapses. Everyone doesn't want it anymore. They want to be free. Or suddenly, like, you know, all these people in the world, they're in this death project of global capitalism and all the rest of it. It's getting worse and worse and worse. And suddenly there's a little bit of a contestation. There's a bit of conflict. What is this? You see what I mean? It's like, it's our last chance. Let's escape. This is the escape route. That's non-linearity, right? That's social repression, non-linearity. Everyone's going for it. It's enormously important that people understand how this works, right? Because it's very empowering to realize that when things get really bad, they're actually about to get a lot better. I mean, there's no guarantees, okay? But it often happens. Okay, so I'm just going to give this little example, right? So, you know, for the last 3 months, I've been going around the UK, I'm giving talks about why people should step into civil resistance, you know, get arrested, go to prison, what have you. And if you're aware of the climate movement in the UK, you know, you go out and do a talk, the age range is, you know, maybe 70% of people in the room are 40, 50 and above. Okay, so it's mainly older people. And there's a certain amount of social repression there. And you do the talk and they go, oh my God, I've got to act, and they sign up, right? And let's say, for the sake of argument, well, I know what the stats are, you know, you go and talk to 20 people, you'll get 3 or 4 people to sign up to engage in civil disobedience to the point of arrest or prison, let's say. So, you know, there's repression, there's the release of the talk, oh my God, and yes, I'm prepared to act. So the repression is released, a little bit like a small jail, right? They're all running out of that jail. They can see a pathway to escape. And of course, people say to me, well, Roger, the main people that are going to get arrested and go to prison for civil disobedience are obviously going to be the older people because, you know, they've got more time and blah, 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 and whatever it is. And then they say, yeah, young people aren't going to do that because they're not involved in doing that sort of thing. They don't want to do it. There's loads of young people out there and they're not doing anything. And therefore, that's because they don't want to. Well, that's an assumption. What we know for certain is they're not doing anything, but we don't know why, right? So my proposition is the reason why young people, their mobilization levels are pretty miserable is because they're even more socially repressed. They're even more mad as hell. They're even more depressed and in despair. They're even more thinking, it's useless, I can't get out of this prison. You know, I've got another 70 years to live and it's gonna be hell. So then you go and do the talk to them. So I did this. So I went to talk to like 8 young people. And I did the talk and said, you know, it's really terrible and here's a pathway to concrete political change. And then you have a go round at the end and one of them just goes, I'm gonna do it. And it's like a trigger point, right? It's a little bit like that person suddenly seeing this little chink in the door of the prison and you say, I'm going for that. And then suddenly like the whole group of young people, all 8 of them, sign up. So it's a bit like the greater the repression, the bigger the release, right? The bigger the non-linear explosion of anger and frustration and the desire to actually do whatever it takes, right? Like the Freedom Riders, we can't afford to lose. That's it. We've got an escape route. So that's 8 out of 8, right? So usually with the older people, you'll get like 20 people and you'll get say 4. With this group of young people, I got more people signing up than ever from 30 different talks. And they're all young people. So that's what's making these people, the younger people, potentially be the revolutionaries that they soon will be. Okay, this is what happens over and over again in history. And we're establishing that the more repressed it is, the bigger the explosion. You know, it's a bit like a relationship. Things build up and someone screams their head off, right? That's what we're looking at. Okay. The real problem is not that the Arctic's icing, right? The Arctic's melting. It's not that the Amazon's going to disappear. The real reason why we're going to go extinct is because of the frog in the boiling pan, right? You might be familiar with this analogy. So you put the frog in the pan and you gradually heat it up. And it's like at any one point, it's not really getting that hotter. So it never jumps out of the pan. So that when it gets to boiling point, it's dead. So the proposition is all these people out there, they've just had, you know, 6 weeks of continuously bad climate news, right? Every week there's records broken and, you know, things are just getting worse and worse. And next year it's going to be a little bit worse. And it's like there's no actual trigger point. So the proposition is we're gradually descending into hell globally. So that's the bad news. But the good news is that's not actually what's happening. What's happening and what will happen is that the nature of ecological collapse is not, you know, everything gradually disappearing into crap. It's like everything's pretty bad. And then suddenly, bang, right? This is what I call an ecological 9/11. In other words, out of nowhere, like 50,000 people have died in Phoenix, Arizona because, you know, the electricity collapsed and it was 50 degrees. Or 3 million people died in Karachi because it's 50 degrees centigrade for 2 weeks. Like that's, it's like there's this tipping point and suddenly like there's this massive global event. So this is structurally inevitable because we're dealing with physical processes. So you get these big, you know, things, you know, like 9/11, you know, 3,000 people were killed in New York, and then, you know, things went back to normal a little bit again, right? With the ecological 9/11s, of course, they're physically determined, so they're going to happen again, bang, right? And gets, so every time one of these happens, there's a potentiality of social explosion, because people go, it's so bad, and then some people, that triggers outlier people to go, I'm not taking this anymore. And basically, that's how revolutions start historically. Is there's a big crisis, no bread, and people go hungry, and it's like bang, and then it just explodes, and there's this massive change.
You're listening to Roger Hallam, Extinction Rebellion, the Climate Crisis, and Civil Resistance. This is Independent Alternative Radio. To get copies of this program, just call us 1-800-444-1977. Again, that's 1-800-444-1977. Or go online, our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org.
What this talk is about, and the whole proposition behind Extinction Rebellion and the whole civil resistance model, is we can't wait for society just to shake its dice. You see what I mean? For the ecological system. What we need to do is proactively create, non-violently, a massive disruption which triggers this explosion that opens the prison door. And again, like, there's no absolute guarantee, but I'm going to show you how to shake dice so that the whole system gets shaken up. And the point I'm trying to make is it's entirely possible through creating civil resistance proactively. What's that civil resistance broadly going to look like? It's going to look similar to the Freedom Ride. It's going to look similar to April 2019. In other words, we have to create a coherent strategy, a coherent design with lots of different elements. And all of those elements are important. The mobilization, the action, the framing, they all have to be brought together. That's the first thing. Secondly, it has to happen fast. And lastly, we need to have a detailed focus on the micro design, as it's called, right? The different elements need to be studied in detail because the devil's in the detail. And before I get onto the practice, I want to say, like, that all around the world at the moment, there's this sort of broad divergence. There's this, you know, regression of the environmental movement back into marches and performative protest and highlighting things and all the rest of it, because it's a comfortable, right? It's a comfort in the face of this social repression, in the face of this astronomically awful thing. It's completely understandable and it's completely dysfunctional. And then there's this sort of divergence of people going, no, no, no. You know, we don't want performance. We want survival. We want justice. How are we actually going to do it, right? We don't want to just say we want it. We've got to make it happen. So how are we going to make it happen? So how do we translate this into practice? What you might call the new model of civil resistance. What does that look like? So the first thing, which is absolutely critical, is the civil resistance episode has to be organized by a small number of people. Small groups throughout history, they get together, they have the chemistry, they have the intelligence, they have the risk-taking, and they go and do it. So what is it about small groups that's going to make them effective? First of all, a small group can act fast. That's critical. It has, like, a coherent strategy. Five people can sit down and they can put together something that actually makes sense in terms of mobilization, action, framing, because there's not too many fingers in the pie. It can have a culture of hard work. Right, these things go together. It's acting fast. It's exciting, right? Small group. They bond together well. They come up with a really exciting strategy. They're mobilized then to work hard. Working hard is absolutely essential, right? They're able to pivot quickly. So if you look at, like, the history of Extinction Rebellion, it was driven by these small teams, right? It was fast. There wasn't enough time to sort of start thinking about accountability and consulting people. It was like, this is it. We're going to do April 2019. Bang, 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 bang. Right? Now, interestingly enough, like once April 2019 happened, it became bureaucratized. It's like suddenly there's lots of groups, you know, rightly or wrongly wanting a finger in the pie and making decisions because they're involved. You know, it might make ethical sense, but it's useless when it comes to high-level civil resistance. So there's a bunch of dynamics in a large established group. To just give you a flavor, what tends to happen is once people are in a large group and it's been going for 6 months, people tend to start going, that's my patch, you know, and they get a little bit jealous of innovation. It's like, I didn't think of that. I mean, this is just human nature, okay? You know, and you get a groupthink, you have this conservatism. It's like, we don't want to take those risks because we're doing all these things and these things seem fine. In other words, there's not the willingness or ability to pivot rapidly. And so you just replicate the old game, which obviously doesn't work because you've got to keep changing. So you're not able to pivot. Okay, so what does this practically mean? Because this has a real practicality to it. The practicality is this. There's two scenarios. You start a project, you start a campaign, and you headhunt the five people that are most competent to work with you. Or you go into the organisation you're in, whether it's Fridays for Future or XR or some activist group, and you make this proposition. This is what we're going to do. I want a rapid decision-making process to decide a coherent strategy. So you're putting them on the spot. Do you want to do this or don't you? Now, maybe they do, you know, never say never, in which case that's great. But if they say no, or if they say, yeah, well, we're going to discuss it over the next 3 months or whatever, you haven't got time for that. So you have to exit it. This is the fundamental error that people make in terms of creating radical political change, is they stay in a dysfunctional space. Now, that's fine when you're just dealing with, you know, an average revolution or social breakdown situation. We don't have the time to sit in meetings going, this isn't working. This is just repetition of something we know doesn't work. So you have to take that high risk, you and five other people. That's the first point of it. It's not about talking about 100,000 people in the street. How the hell are you going to get that? That's the starting point, is just getting those people. And the great news is around the world, you know, in Fridays Future or XR or all these other environmental groups or whatever, there are people that are seething with frustration that we're not getting anywhere. And they're starting to go, okay, let's just do it. And the great thing is over the last 2 years, there's been this massive upsurge of activism and civil disobedience. So there's loads of people out there who know the tricks of the trade, as you might say. They know how to set up a roadblock. They know how to organize media. Like 2 years ago, when we started XR, it's like 80% of people haven't even been arrested before. That's not the case. The case now is this is our moment for this radical move out of this like inertia space into the ballpark of catching the ball in the next 3 years. So I just want to emphasize here, this is like profoundly empirical. What I'm trying to say by that is if there's a, you know, a group of people and they run an organization, and they want to enact this radical mobilization strategy, fantastic, right? It's not like I've got anything against big groups. It's not like I've got anything against participatory sort of structures. What I'm saying is one way or another, you have to move into that zone of high risk, coherent strategy, rapid mobilization. Number two, the structural weakness of the opposition. You have to design your confrontation at the moment when the opposition is weak, okay? The opposition isn't some monolith sort of situation. It's not a brick wall. It's a fluid social construction. What that means is sometimes it's strong, sometimes it's not so strong. So for instance, in 1961, with the Freedom Riders episode, you know, you have all that drama of what was happening in Alabama. But, you know, smart sociologists have pointed out that one of the key reasons they won was because in 1961, President Kennedy was in the middle of the Cold War and he was making out that America is great and, you know, there's all this liberty and equality and I'm the leader of the free world. And he was going to go on this big conference with Khrushchev, the leader of the Soviet Union, in Vienna. And then what happened was, around the world news, there was black people with blood coming down their faces because they wanted to sit with a white person on the bus, right? It was an absolute disaster. It was genius timing. And you're like, Kennedy is, you know, on the phone going, get these people off the front pages. He didn't give a damn about civil rights. He didn't give a damn about black people. What he was about was power. He was about winning the Cold War. But he was telling this massive lie. When a society is living a massive lie, the opposition is weak because it's this massively hypocritical thing. That's when you want to go and expose his gross, obscene hypocrisy. So that's the moment to strike. We're not going next year, we're going now. We're going when they're weak. We're determining the moment of resistance. We're not responding to their agendas. So that's pretty straightforward. Number three is high-level disruptive action. We have to go in there with something massively transgressive, massively disruptive, massively outrageous. If you're not doing that, you're not in the ballpark, because you've got to capture mass attention to change history, to change how the society is going to work. This is the complete opposite of performative protest. It's about material disruption. So for instance, like with the Freedom Riders, yeah, they went at the right time. They had a small group. What's the main thing though? The main thing was they didn't stop in Virginia. They went down into the heart of darkness where they were going to be beaten up. They were going to be thrown into jail where the ambulance wouldn't even pick them up. Why? Because they wanted to engage in a massive disruptive exposure of the implicit violence of the racist system. If we're going to challenge the absolute obscenity of the plan to destroy the next generation, we have to go in with something that's outrageously disruptive to say to the general public, to say to the government, this is outrageous and we're not standing for it. And we're doing whatever it non-violently takes to push that into your face. That's how history changes. So it means blocking motorways or blocking ports, blocking the centre of cities. It means unlimited hunger strikes. It's classical non-violence. People get hurt. Sometimes people get killed. That's what it is at this stage in history, right? And I'm not saying that because I'm being macho or radical or whatever. I'm saying it because nothing else is going to create effective civil resistance. And if you engage in effective civil resistance, you know you've engaged with it because the state will put you in prison. In other words, like going to prison is the other side, the sacrifice side, is saying to the society, you can put me in prison and I don't care, and put me in prison for as long as you like. So all classical nonviolence from Gandhi through to Martin Luther King, through to Extinction Rebellion, this is the central proposition, is you disrupt and you're open and you get put into prison, you're arrested and all the rest of it, and you're not fearful. Because the whole point of doing civil disobedience is to become unpopular, because you're trying to tell the public and the government that what's going on is outrageous. That's what you're saying. Of course they're not going to like you. You know, in 1961, Martin Luther King was the most unpopular man in America, for God's sake, right? Of course he was, because he was like disrupting generations of complacent white racism. What we're challenging is millions of people going around their carbon lives going, I don't really care. Well, they're going to have to care, because it's outrageously unjust. And if they don't like that, then so be it. But in the pitch, in the thick of battle, everyone hates you. That's just the way it is. You know, it's what Gandhi calls the fight stage. You know, they ignore you, they laugh at you, and then they fight you and then you win. That's it. So that's like absolutely crucial. And there's only these small number of people who are going to get it, because these people are just wanting a quiet life, right? They just want to turn up, do something twice a year, and tick the box and say, we've had a great protest. That's not going to do it. It's astronomically immoral to be doing that, because we've got 3 to 4 years to save the next generation. Okay, point four, moving along. Point four is having action and mobilization combined together, integrated into a coherent strategic whole. Right, there's this core notion here of the proximity principle. The proximity principle is an easy idea. What it means is if you talk to someone in a meeting and they say, yeah, I'm going to sign up to civil disobedience, and you don't contact them for a week, like 80% of them, for sake of argument, have lost enthusiasm. If you phone them in the next day, 80% of them are still there. In other words, like everything has to be fast and furious, right? Everything is moving along because there's this emotion. Mobilization, civil resistance is driven by emotion. It's not driven by some tick-boxing rationality. Oh, I will now do civil disobedience. No, the real engine of civil resistance is the mobilization process, right? That's going on behind the scenes, all that boring stuff, ringing up, booking venues, you know, talking to groups and getting them to support it, you know, finding speakers, organizing the meetings, put it on social media, all that work. Without that work, nothing's going to happen. All that's going to happen is people are going to go, wow, that's amazing, and then carry on, because there's no pathway to action. You know, Martin Luther King used to do like 5 speeches a day. That's how you change history. You don't go, oh, I'm off to recover now. It's like, that's how you change history. You know, have 2 days off and then you're out around the country doing a tour, talking to people. And people go, oh my God, this person's gone to prison. Here's a pathway to actual action. I'll do it as well. And they sign up. So you go again, note the time. Not like 4 months later, not in 2 weeks. You go once you've got those 50 people. The 50 people go to prison. If 50 people go to prison in this country, newspaper people have said it'll be on the front page. It's major. This is the most important information in the Western world at this moment in history, dare I say it, because it shows the nature of social repression, right? The social repression is a hypothesis. We don't know. I mean, people are walking along the road. They could not care. We have some sort of evidence because in the UK, 55% of people are very concerned about the climate. So if you do a normal distribution analysis, you know that maybe 5% of those people are having sleepless nights. So there's people out there, and this is the evidence. If you go and deliver leaflets in the UK, broadly speaking, and arguably anywhere in a Western city, you deliver 5,000 leaflets. The leaflets have to be in your face. It's not like London climate change campaign invites you to a talk by Professor blah, blah, blah. No one's bothered about that. What people are bothered about is a leaflet that says, all hell's breaking loose. We know, you know, come and talk about it. Because most of the people that are going to get it aren't bothered, right? Well, they're so like repressed, they're not going to respond. But that 1% of people, right? 5,000 leaflets, maybe 10,000 people look at it. 30 to 50 people arrive at the talk. These are the people that are going to change the regime. These are the lone wolves. Many of these people have never been involved in politics. This is the beauty of doing leafleting. You're getting out of the nice environmental siloed, you know, bubble. So here's the jackpot. In other words, like you're giving people this talk and it's just forcing your way through the social repression. They've already subliminally prepared themselves because they've decided to come to the talk. They sort of subliminally already know what they're going to be told because they sort of know it. But then they're told it, and then there's like this outpouring of desire to actually make a difference. And in that talk, you make a pathway to action, which is in 4 weeks, we're going to be doing this next stage of the civil resistance thing, right? And you sign up. So here we are. This is the most important part of this talk. Go and do the maths. In most Western democracies, if, say, 3,000 people are arrested, then you'll get legislative change. In most Western democracies, if 300-400 people go to prison, you'll get legislative change. You know, give or take. The point is, there's a tipping point, so you go and do the maths, right? Maybe you need to have 1,000 meetings, so go and do the maths, right? That involves 100 people working full-time, going to a rich people. You know, if you come up with a concrete plan, they'll give you money. Say, you need £100,000 and we're going to do this over 3 months and we're going to get 1,000 people ready to be arrested. We're going to get 400 people ready to go to prison. You see how that works? So you've got the combination of people that have already done it, going and doing these meetings. Then you've got the combination of this full-on leaflet, attracting people that have never been involved in this sort of thing before. And the paradox, incidentally, is if they haven't been involved in it, they're a lot fresher. So you might think, this is impossible, you know. Someone that's never been involved in a climate change movement, they go from zero to being prepared to go to prison. Yes, two of them, because this provides them with a mechanism, a means to achieve some redemption, some sense of purpose, some feeling that they're actually making something of their life when we're facing this astronomically awful situation. That's how it works. What we need to mobilize is people, not institutions, not movements, people. And that's how you do it, is going out and talking to them. That's how it's going to work. That's how you create a civil resistance episode in 6 months. That's how you change the world. Number five, right? Strategic intelligence is to think, who are you trying to influence in order to influence the people who are going to reduce carbon emissions? In other words, the government that's going to bring in legislation. In other words, you need something at this moment in history that makes the break into a post-green agenda. So for 30 years, environmentalism was, you know, here's the world and out there is the environment and it's a little bit twitchy and we have to go and clean it up every now and again. Those days are gone. The reality now is that the environment is everything. Like, this is a bread and butter crisis. It's a concern to everyone. So what this means is, if you're going to be smart, the fifth thing you have to do is create a demand. You need to create a demand anyway, because there's no point blocking motorways and what have you and just going, there's a climate crisis, we're upset about it. Everyone knows that, right? That's performative. What you have to do, and all the geniuses and masters of civil resistance and non-violence over the last 150 years, there is a demand, a concrete demand. And the demand has to have broad appeal. You know, this is why Gandhi did the salt march. The people in the Congress party were going, salt, you know, what's that got to do with independence? It doesn't matter. It's popular. Everyone in India understands that it's an outrage that they're taxed on salt. Then make the campaign about that. And number six is make a demand that's winnable. Now, this is so smart and so, like, not often done. And a massive part of maturing the civil resistance mechanism is to start off with winnable demands. In other words, you're strategic. Don't start off asking for the earth. You start off by something that's winnable with the resources you have at this moment in time. So for instance, no one thought like desegregating interstate buses was going to bring the downfall of structural racism in 1960s America. So why did they demand a desegregation of interstate buses? Because they could win it. So this civil resistance model is, you have these small group of people, they do this massive disruption, they do this massive mobilization thing, and they win something. So you've got people in prison and they've won, right? Two things. You're going around the country. This is how we won. This is the sacrifice. It's impressive. It's walking the talk. It's not like abstract. It's not talking about social justice. It is social justice, and that wakes people up. Everything has to be directed towards that objective at this moment. People have to be prepared to engage in civil disobedience, to be arrested. People have to be prepared to engage in civil disobedience to the point of prison. People have to be prepared to give up their jobs, lose their family relationships, right? Lose their housing. People have to be prepared for that level of sacrifice. Otherwise, we're not in the ballpark of causing the disruption that's necessary. But that's two things to say. No, to sum up, situation is beyond bad. That's just the way it is. And what I'm really trying to say is what, you know, Mandela said, or I think he said, which is some variation on the theme, which is, our greatest fear is not of the powerful. Our greatest fear is of our own power. You are absolutely powerful. You absolutely can do this stuff. You know, there's no excuses. So good luck. And thanks very much.
You were just listening to Roger Hallam, Extinction Rebellion, the Climate Crisis, and Civil Resistance. He spoke in London, England. Roger Hallam is an environmental activist and co-founder of Extinction Rebellion and the political party Burning Pink. This program is produced by Alternative Radio, based in Boulder, Colorado. We are an independent nonprofit in our 36th year. We're supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature such progressive voices as Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz, Ralph Nader, Chris Hedges, and Vandana Shiva. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. To place a credit card order for CDs of today's program and for the Noam Chomsky book, Climate Crisis and the Global Green New Deal, just call us at 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or you can order online on our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org. We're offering printed transcripts, PDFs, and MP3s of this program at no charge. Just call us, 1-800-444-1977. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamyan. Thank you for listening.